Please at 7:06.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants. Since 1985, offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. With 30 points, Jason Kidd led the New Jersey Nets past the Spurs 87-85 in San Antonio last night. The Nets win evens the NBA Finals Series at one game apiece. It was the first game that New Jersey had won in the finals after five losses, four to the Lakers last spring and one to the Spurs on Wednesday night. The series shifts to New Jersey tomorrow night. San Antonio went into the current series as a slight favorite over New Jersey. To say that recent NBA finals rarely feature two evenly matched teams would be to grossly understate the matter. The Lakers' recent three-peat is one example of that phenomenon, as is the 1976 NBA Finals, when the heavily favored Boston Celtics took on an upstart team for the NBA championship. Though the Celtics eventually subdued the Phoenix Suns 4-2, the teams did play what many consider the greatest game in league history, Game 5 of those 76 finals. Members of that Phoenix Suns team still vividly remember that contest, though some would rather not. Steve Goldstein of member station KJZZ in Phoenix has our report.
And the shot! He got it!
June 4th, 1976. The Phoenix Suns are playing in their first NBA championship series after finishing only 2 games over .500 during the regular season. The Suns' best player, Paul Westphal, hadn't even been able to crack the Celtics' regular rotation after being Boston's 1972 first-round draft pick. Phoenix play-by-play man Al McCoy says neither the press nor the Boston fans thought much of the Suns.
So it was a surprise to the basketball world when these guys from the desert, and as the Boston media said at that time, with white socks and brown shoes, came in to try and go against the big green machine and all their championships. The Boston Celtics.
Sun center Alvin Adams was rookie of the year in 1976. He'd been a 20-year-old hardship case out of Oklahoma who'd never seen an NBA game in person until he'd played in one. He says the Boston Garden was an intimidating place, especially in the playoffs.
We walked through a glass door, looked like an entrance to an office building, and then we went downstairs past some strange noises and strange smells. And, of course, the Celtics always made sure the heat was turned up very high in the locker room, so we just sat in there and melted. So we tried to make sure we went out and stayed on the court and as much as we could during warm-up. Then, of course, they'd run the live wires for the television feeds through the shower area after game, hoping to electrocute us.
In 1976, guard Dick Van Arsdale had been in the league for 11 years. He was thrilled to be playing in the finals anywhere, even in the tricky Garden.
There were a lot of dead spots in the Boston Garden, and if you had to know where to dribble, if you hit one spot that was dead, the ball would go down and I'd come back up. And, of course, all the Celtics players knew where those spots were.
The Celtics' home court advantage in Game 5 translated into a 20-point first-half lead, but a dominant second half enabled Phoenix to rise from the ashes and send the battle to overtime. But it was the second extra session that would make Game 5 one for the ages.
Nelson looking. He has the ball. Trying to get it to Havlicek. He finally does. 4 seconds to go. Havlicek with three. His shot with two is good. The ball game is over. The ball game is over. Hold the phone. Hold the phone. The Celtic fans are going bananas. The game is not over. I don't think the game is over. There's 2 seconds remaining, I do believe.
The referees decided to give Phoenix 1 second on the clock, and the Suns took full advantage.
1 second remaining in the second overtime. Here's Perry to Gar Hurd. Here's the jump shot. Good! It's good! It counts! Gar Hurd ties it! We'll go to the third overtime. I gotta take a breather. Garfield Hurd made the basket.
The third overtime was close but sloppy, and the Celtics emerged with the victory 128-126. 2 nights later, Boston closed out the series in Phoenix. But no one really remembers that one. Suns owner Jerry Colangelo, then the team's general manager, knew that Game 5 would be remembered.
I do recall in the wee hours of the morning, many of us just sitting back reflecting on what had transpired. We knew we had been a part of history, that this would be be one of the classics of all time.
Guard Dick Van Arsdale, the first player ever to wear a Suns uniform, was proud to be in Game 5, but he wishes people remembered a contest he'd actually won.
A friend of mine will call and say, I just saw Game 5 on TV again. I said, don't tell me. I don't want to hear about it anymore.
Unfortunately, they were not able to restrain this crowd, which, of course, gathered here at halftime and came rushing onto the court after John Havlicek made the pressure-packed play underneath.
For Only a Game, I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, Arizona.
Shot and went cleanly through after banking off the glass. The Celtics have come back out onto the court.
The big story at the French Open this week was Venus Williams losing, until it was replaced by the story of Serena Williams losing. Joining me from Paris to speak of these and other unlikely developments is our tennis guy, Bud Collins. Hello, Bud.
Well, Bill, it's the unlikely that keeps me going, I think. it's like this kid, this big Dutchman, Martin Verkerk. Who ever heard of Verkerk?
Well, everybody's going to hear of him if he wins the finals tomorrow, right?
Well, that's right. That's absolutely right. And he's wonderful. He gave the best interviews that I've ever heard in 30 years hanging around this place. He's just so up and bright and self-effacing and makes fun of himself, but it discusses how his career was in shambles only a year ago. And he's, I think, the people's choice.
His opponent is Juan Carlos Ferrero. How do you see that match?
Well, Ferrero should win. He's a very tough clay court guy. He lost the final last year. He wasn't in top shape physically, and Albert Costa beat him, and he beat Costa on Friday. So he ought to win, but I just think that Verkerk has caught lightning somewhere. He's got a magnificent serve. He comes into the net, which is unusual around here these days. And he really believes in himself. He says, it's either a joke or a dream. And he said, I'll take either one.
I like it.
Yeah.
Now, on the women's side, Bud, I don't know which was more shocking, that Serena Williams lost or that the crowd seemed so delighted that she had lost. What was that all about?
Well, they were delighted because, for one thing, you know, Justine Henin Ardenne is a girl next door. She's from Belgium. And I think there were a lot of factors. She was an underdog. I don't like to call a woman an underdog. Let's say she wasn't the favorite. But she has such an attractive game. And when she goes out on the court, of course, she's somebody that Serena could pack in her racket bag. She's a tiny thing, about 5'4", 120 pounds. But she hits the heck out of the ball. And when people sensed that she had a chance, I don't think anybody thought she had a chance. When it started, she roared off to a 3-love lead and won the first set pretty quickly. Then they really started going for her. The crowd was a little rude. There's no doubt about that. It was rowdy, but it reminded me of the crowd in 1999 when Steffi Graf upset Martina Hingis in the final, and they were all over Hingis because she had not been too sporting. Well, some of the things that Serena did, Serena was not unsporting, but the crowd seemed to think she was. A couple of times on line calls when the umpire came down to inspect them, she hadn't asked him, but when that happens, the crowd, they just went all out for this kid from Belgium, and it's such a good story. Belgian has never had a major championship in tennis, but it can't miss this time.
That's right.
Because she's up against Kim Clijsters. So it's a given. The king, King Albert II, I don't know him personally, but he'll be here. His queen, Paula, and I'm told that Belgium is going to clear out and everybody's going to be here.
At least one account of the match that Serena Williams lost presented it as a match Serena Williams lost rather than a match that Henin Ardenne won. How did you see it?
Well, take your pick, because there was a little of each. Serving for the match at 5-4, Justine choked. She told me she choked, and it was obvious she choked. She double-faulted twice, and she hit two wild shots. So it was Serena's match, and Serena had led 4-2, 30-love. So the kid choked, but she got a second chance, and few chokers do that. And she got a second chance because Serena was nervous, too. So at the end, it was a battle of nerves, but the way the kid closed it out was sensational, with two service winners and a beautiful lob that Serena couldn't reach. And so I would say a little of each, except it was a day for Belgium, and so I give a little edge choking less to Justine and Hardin.
Well, now, can Hanine Hardin play well enough after the euphoric victory over the number one player in the world to get up again for the final?
Well, that's what every Belgian reporter in the joint has asked me. And I say, yes, I believe she can. Normally, no, because I think that she did so much against Serena, and there has to be a letdown, maybe. But I think because of the Belgium aspect of it and the fact that all those red, yellow, and black flags are going to be flying and everybody's going to be dressed like a red devil, which is the nickname of Belgian sporting teams, and they have horned hats and so on, and it's going to be such a big, big Belgian thing that I think both of these kids are going to bust a gut to win, and knowing that Belgium can't lose.
It's a kind of an American way to look at events, Bud, but what do we see from the Williams sisters now as they have to respond to this very unusual circumstance, namely losing?
It is unusual in their lives, and I think that Venus is a special case. I think her career has really been diminished by the success of her sister. I think that she's in a daze right now. She lost in the fourth round to a kid she seemed to have beaten, a young Russian, Vera Zvonareva. But she went home. She wasn't present for Serena's match. That is very unusual. But for Serena, she said, I'm going to have to work harder because next is Wimbledon. And I believe she means it. I think she could very well come back and win Wimbledon. But I do believe that the days of the all-Williams major finals may be over.
Bud Collins writes about tennis for the Boston Globe, and he talks about it on television for NBC. Thank you, Bud.
Thank you, Bill.
It's 18 minutes past the hour.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Hillary Clinton's new book, Is It a Prelude to a Presidency? Read more about the story at WBUR.org. Just click on News. Coming up on Only a Game, Funny Side makes a bid to make racing history and old-time baseball in Old Sturbridge Village. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Wheelworks of Belmont and Somerville, offering service and selection for casual cyclists and cycling enthusiasts for 26 years. Wheelworks.com, the New England bicycle source. Dixon Peabody LLP, providing legal services to local, national, and global businesses with offices in the East and in California, on the web at DixonPeabody.com. And Tachi Building Corporation, working with progressive clients and architects to construct dynamic commercial, institutional, and residential spaces for growing communities. TOCCI.com. The weather forecast calling for some sun early this morning, then showers developing later today. Highs near 70. Showers tonight, a chance of thunderstorms after midnight, lows in the mid-50s. And tomorrow, mostly cloudy, a chance of showers through early afternoon with a thunderstorm possible, highs 70 to 75. In Boston now, it's 63 degrees, on Nantucket, 56.
Click and Clack have something special for your dad this Father's Day, an original Car Talk tie.
From a distance, it looks like a standard issue striped silk businesswear tie. But when you get up close, you see that the stripes are actually made up of all the names in our credits.
That's right, like our staff dietitian, Diana Hunger.
Order a Car Talk tie for your dad by calling 800-909-9287 or online at WBUR.org.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a discussion with the author of a book about the horse that won the Belmont Stakes 50 years ago, Native Dancer. But first, a discussion with Jenny Reese, our scribe for the sport of sires and dams, joining us from the press box at Belmont Park. Hey, Jenny.
Hey, Bill.
All eyes will be on Funnyside this afternoon, of course, as he goes for the Triple Crown. Funnyside, like Seabiscuit and numbers of other horses down the years, has been characterized as the people's horse. What exactly does that mean?
That means maybe if you took out a loan, you could afford to buy him.
Any of us, you mean?
Any of us, yeah. That's right. Or if you have enough charge cards. But he really has just captivated people, because this wasn't a prince or a sheik or a titan of industries that bought these horses. It's, you know, 10 guys, five of them former high school buddies, you know, pooled their money together and bought this horse. And you think about it, you know, they paid $75,000 for him, divided by 10, although it's not completely split up that way. But still, that's something that if you don't have kids in college, you could swing maybe.
Backers of Funnyside say their horse should have an advantage because Belmont Park is Funnyside's home track and he's undefeated there, but Funnyside's prime opponent is also undefeated at Belmont, right?
That's right. That's a great thing about racing, that you can find sets of circumstances that work for about any horse in there.
Mm-hmm.
But that is true. You know, Funnyside, he trained here for the Derby, he trained here for the Preakness, and this time he just gets to walk out from his own barn.
The argument for Empire Maker, the other horse undefeated at Belmont Park, is that he's fresh after skipping the Preakness and that his trainer, Bobby Frankel, is a master at getting a rested horse ready to run. That's some track talk for you there. Is rest more important than momentum today?
Not according to statistics. Again, we can get something to fit every horse, but only one horse has ever won the Belmont that ran in the Derby and not in between, and that was commendable. In 2000, when both the Derby and the Preakness winner were not there. And while Bobby Frankel does have a great in-the-money percentage in the Triple Crown race, he is seeking still his first one. It is ironic, when the spring prep races were going on, the horse we all thought, if there was going to be a Triple Crown, was Empire Maker.
Right.
And now he's left in the role of trying to be the spoiler.
I've read a couple of arguments about why Empire Maker is really the better horse, had an off day at the Derby, et cetera, et cetera. Do you buy those?
I think it was incredible hype. Starting with the Courier Journal, we were all over the horse, writing about, you know, his mother and the farm and the trainer, and he is bred to be a top horse. But as racing shows, and while racing is so appealing to a lot of people, including, like, little guys, is that you don't always have to have the best bred, the most expensive horse to have the fastest horse. And Funnyside is a very fast horse that Empire Maker simply could not catch in the Kentucky Derby.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the other four horses in the field. Can you find a sleeper among Supervisor, Die Never, Scrimshaw, and your own ill-fated Derby pick, 10 Most Wanted?
I was hoping you wouldn't remember that, but yes. I cannot forget 10 Most Wanted. After I was so high on him at the Kentucky Derby, and I was talking to, you know, one of the owners yesterday of him, and, you know, they were really sort of stunned they didn't win because Pat Day had been so high, and that was part of my thinking, too. He's still a grand-looking colt. You just, you know, you have to question, you know, is he really good enough? But I suppose it's possible that this scenario could happen. Funnyside looks like the controlling speed, the main speed in the race. But Jerry Bailey on Empire Maker is not going to let him get too far away. He doesn't want to have to chase him down from very far off. He wants to be, you know, right near on his flank and press the horse and let's see what Funnyside is made of. If they go too fast, a 10 Most Wanted could come by and pick up the pieces.
Mm-hmm. I've read that people in the racing business are rooting hard for Funnyside because a Triple Crown winner is so good for business at the track. Has anybody actually measured that in terms of attendance and wagers made?
Well, you know, when you do have a Derby winner and he shows up at other races down the road, you do see a bump, you know, what the statistics are. You know, it's not in a vacuum, but tracks do see it. You know, when Silver Charm raced as a 4- and 5-year-old, there would be big days wherever he would race.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the other thing is, you know, Funnyside cannot be a stallion. He is a gelding, which the amazing thing, while most racehorses are gelded, when this one won the Kentucky Derby, people were just like, how could they have done that to the Derby winner? Not realizing that it's not necessarily such a great thing as a stallion to be a Kentucky Derby winner. A lot of them have been flops instead. But here's a horse, one reason racing's so excited, that figures to race at 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. John Henry was a horse of the year at age 9, and this is what they're hoping to see. And that combined with having owners that people can identify with, hey, that could be me in those yellow pants, you know, on the Preakness winner's circle and posting and having a great time and coming in on the school bus, which, by the way, they're increasing exponentially. They went from one yellow school bus to the Derby to two at the Preakness, and they will have four bringing them to Belmont Park.
So plenty of owners and friends of owners of Funnyside will be there.
Absolutely, yes, and that's the other thing. Yes, your friends do increase as your horse keeps winning.
All right, Jenny, it's time for the moment of the illusion of truth. Who wins today?
I just think things are all going into place for Funny Side. He is a seriously good horse. And the other thing is, while he lost his first three races this year, he had a breathing complication, a thing with some, it's complicated, but with some mucus that was like congesting in his throat. And that has been cleared up like right before the Derby. So this could be a horse that's just getting better and better.
Jenny Rees writes about the horses for the Louisville Courier-Journal and talks about them for Only a Game. Thank you, Jenny.
My pleasure.
The Belmont Stakes takes on great importance when one of the horses in the field has won both the Kentucky Derby and the Preakness. In fact, when the entries don't include a Triple Crown prospect, the Belmont sometimes assumes a kind of stunted status. But that was not the case in 1953, when Native Dancer, beaten by a nose in the Derby, was the Belmont's prime attraction. John Eisenberg has written a book about Native Dancer, subtitled The Gray Ghost, Hero of a Golden Age. He joins me now from the studios of WYPR in Baltimore. John, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Native Dancer came into the 1953 Derby not only as the favorite, but as a horse that had never failed to be the favorite. And in fact, Native Dancer was the better's choice every single time he ran, even after he finished second at Churchill Downs. That has to be extremely unusual.
Well, I'm sure it is. And as a matter of fact, he was below even money odds, I believe, all but twice in his career. Certainly the first time he raced, I think he went off at 7-5. And, every time after that, he was, until the last race, I believe he was under even money. So he was definitely the better's favorite.
And a fair portion of that was people just loved the horse. I mean, it wasn't all mathematical calculation.
No, as a matter of fact, very little mathematical calculation. After a while, I think that it was out of love. A lot of people, I think, put money on this horse and didn't cash the ticket. That's the story I've heard. To have a piece of Native Dancer was more important than any money's won, when, of course, at those short odds, you weren't going to win much money anyway.
A syndrome the track must have applauded.
Well, probably so. I don't know how many people did that, but I did in my research run across several, quite a few who did that. And this was a horse that captured America's heart. And in a way, it's when I say that no horse has, I always hear from people who are fans of Citation or Man of War or Secretariat. And certainly there are arguments to be said for those horses capturing the hearts of America. They all obviously did. What made Native Dancer interesting was the way that he did it on television as really the first televised horse and really the first sports star that was on television.
That is one of the recurrent themes in your book, that television came of age at the same time Native Dancer burst on the scene. And he had going for him, among other things, a photogenic quality because of his color.
Yes. This is 1953. As I said, he broke in as a two-year-old in 1952. And, of course, television was just evolving as an industry. The late 40s is when the networks sort of crystallized, and there were national television, coast-to-coast broadcast, didn't exist until the laying of the coaxial cable, which was completed in November of 1951. Native Dancer hits the scene in April of 1952, and, of course, the sets were a little 10-inch black and white, fuzzy. The technology wasn't too good. Native Dancer was gray, and a very vivid gray, and as a result, all of the other horses looked the same on those 10-inch sets. They were black, and Native Dancer was closest thing to white.
So, luminous.
Luminous. So the old joke was that even Grandma could pick him out coming down the stretch.
Having lost the Derby to Dark Star and broke a lot of hearts in the process, Native Dancer won the Preakness. But I gather that a lot of observers, at least the kind of hard-bitten old track guys, felt that the horse still had a lot to prove at Belmont Park.
Without a doubt. The loss in the Derby was, of course, catastrophic for his millions and millions of fans, and a great controversial race debated to this day. And he came back and he won the Withers Stakes. It was actually raced in between the Derby and the Preakness. And then he won the Preakness. His Preakness performance was not very impressive. Dark Star was injured in that race in the stretch run and ultimately retired. And Native Dancer failed to put away a horse by the name of Jamie Kay.
Mm-hmm.
It was a horse that had done little before then and actually did very little after then. But Eddie R. Caro was riding Jamie Kay that day and rode just an absolutely brilliant race and took a run at Native Dancer in the stretch and gained quite a bit of ground on a better horse in the stretch. And Native Dancer had to fight all the way to the end of that race to put away a horse that was a long shot. And really, in hindsight, a lot of people said that his performance in the Derby was better than his performance in the Preakness. He had just infinite number of problems in winning in the Kentucky Derby, several of which contributed to his defeat. But he came on majestically in the final 200 yards, and it was a huge effort. It just wasn't enough. In the Preakness, he didn't have any of those problems. He just didn't run very well, but he did manage to win.
At least as interesting as Native Dancer is the family that owned the horse, the Vanderbilt family. Late in his life, Alfred Vanderbilt himself was asked by his daughter to sum up that life. Tell us about how he answered her.
Well, the answer that he provided was Alfred had been married and divorced three times, and when his daughter asked him to sum up his life, he says, got married, got divorced, went to the track. Got married, got divorced, went to the track. Got married, got divorced, went to the track. So Alfred Gwynn Vanderbilt was a brilliant man, could have been a musician, could have been a politician, was a superb racetrack operator in his 20s. He is the one, of course, who put together the famous match race at Pimlico between Seabiscuit and War Admiral that has gotten so much acclaim. That was his baby. When he was 27, he did that.
Yeah.
He could have done a number of things, but as he said, all I wanted was the racetrack. And he spent his whole life operating a stable, but doing whatever he could for the best interests of the sport. And he was in many leadership positions. And racing was his life, and there is a Native Dancer was his greatest horse, and Native Dancer was his chance to win the Kentucky Derby. He never won it, and after Native Dancer's loss, in some ways it broke his heart. He never raced another horse in the Kentucky Derby, and as a matter of fact, he never attended another Kentucky Derby.
Wow.
He could not bring himself to come to Louisville.
Beyond winning 21 of his 22 races, Native Dancer was exceptionally successful at producing winners and horses that would produce even more winners generations down the line. I haven't done my homework, but is Funnyside by any chance a descendant of Native Dancer?
Yes. Funnyside is a great, great, I believe I have this right, great, great grandson, great, great, great grandson, I believe, of Native Dancer. And as a matter of fact, that is quite a story because, indeed, Native Dancer, when he went to stud, it was, and he died in 1967, 13 crops of horses. And, of course, he was so popular that it was thought that he would be the greatest sire of all time. When he died in 1967, he was perceived as a mild disappointment. He had produced one Derby winner as a son, Kauai King, in 1966. Another grandson, Northern Dancer, had won the Derby. Then he died, and really since his death is when things have just gotten better and better and better for the line that he produced. Northern Dancer went on to become maybe the greatest sire of the second half of the 20th century, greatest sire of champions. And then also in the line, his son, Raise a Native, became a great sire of speed. And then you have other horses that have come along within a couple of generations, such as Ali Dar and Mr. Prospector, who mm-hmm. also became probably the greatest sire, American sires of champions, certainly in the last quarter century. So all these horses trace to Native Dancer, and in a way, his name has become the enduring marker of class in a pedigree. That's really the only way to put it. And it just gets better and better. This horse that failed to win the Kentucky Derby in this great gaping hole in his career has now produced, it's the last six winners of the Kentucky Derby, all traced to Native Dancer, and eight of the last nine. And as a matter of fact, this year there was no way he could lose because there were 16 horses in the Kentucky Derby, and all 16 were descendants of Native Dancer. So he's becoming omnipotent in a way.
or at least omnipresent.
Omnipresent. So He is his sire line is a phenomenon. That is the only way to put it. And it's nice to see in the 50th anniversary of his Triple Crown season that he's getting recognized as the great horse and perhaps even better sire that he was.
Well, we may not see a performance as dramatic as Native Dancer's Belmont win 50 years ago, but do you like Funny Side for the Triple Crown?
I have mixed emotions. I would love to see it. I've been in the press box for, I believe, four when the horses have gone for the Triple Crown, the last four, War Emblem and Real Quiet and Silver Charm and Charismatic. And it's such a disappointment when it doesn't happen. This year, I think that Funny Side's chances are good because there's only five other horses in the field, and really, I think, only one that is a challenger, and that is, of course, Empire Maker, who was the favorite in the Derby and has beaten Funny Side just a couple of months ago in the Wood Memorial. So certainly a dangerous threat, and this is a horse, Empire Maker, that has been off for 5 weeks, training for this specific moment with a great trainer, Bobby Frankel. And I fear Empire Maker in this race. I want to see Funny Side win the Triple Crown. I fear that Empire Maker will win the race.
John Eisenberg, who writes for the Baltimore Sun, is the author of Native Dancer, the Gray Ghost Hero of a Golden Age, published by Warner Books. John, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you for having me on.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced, and from the other NPR member stations airing this program. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter McLennan and Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Boston Early Music Festival and Exhibition, June 9th through the 15th, presenting music of the German Baroque and the fully staged opera Ariadne. Tickets at bemf.org. Graham Contracting, since 1982, working to provide intelligent design and construction for discerning residential clients, grahamcontracting.com, and Tufts Health Plan, offering a wide range of health plan designs to meet the needs of employers and their employees. Details at TuftsHealthPlan.com. Good morning, I'm Bob C., and in sports headlines, the Red Sox were beaten by the Milwaukee Brewers last night. The score was 9-3. The two teams will play again tonight in Milwaukee. In NBA playoff action, the New Jersey Nets evened the NBA final series at one game apiece, beating the San Antonio Spurs last night. The score was 87-85. The two teams head to New Jersey for Game 3 tomorrow. And in horse racing, Kentucky Derby and Preakness winner Funny Side goes for the Triple Crown in today's Belmont Stakes. The New York bred gelding would be the first Triple Crown winner in 25 years. Our next Citizens of the World tour is going to Tuscany and Umbria this summer. Learn more about the trip this Monday at a free reception, where you'll sample a four-dish tasting menu of traditional Tuscan foods, including rabbit and boar truffles, courtesy of Bistro 5 in West Medford, and wine specifically paired with each meal. To reserve your space, call 800-909-9287. 61 degrees in Boston at 7:39.
Hey, it's us, Click and Clack, the Tappert Brothers from Car Talk.
The WBUR online auction ends Wednesday, but tomorrow morning is the deadline to bid on a personalized answering machine message from Tom and Ray.
After the beep, leave us the following information. Your name, then your phone numbers, home, parole, officer, all that stuff.
For a personalized answering machine message from Click and Clack, go to WBUR.org before tomorrow's 9 a.m. deadline and make a bid for the news.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, baseball, when it was two words and strikers ran clockwise from post to post. But first, our analyst Charlie Pierce joins me for a discussion of the week's sports news. Hello, Charlie.
Weren't they supposed to run from pillar to post?
Well, we'll get to that in just a minute. On Tuesday, Cubs slugger Sammy Sosa uncorked a doozy in a game against the Tampa Bay Devil Rays. He has since been suspended for 8 games. He will appeal. He will get to play against the Yankees. Are you, like Sammy's corked bat, shattered?
My illusions, such as they were, are all gone from me now, Bill. I woke up the other morning realizing that I wasn't 10 years old anymore. What will we tell the children? Can we all please just lighten up? This used to be, I'm old enough to remember when Gaylord Perry spitting on the ball and somebody else scuffing it and Whitey Ford using the buckles on Elston Howard's shin guards to scrap the ball was like gamesmanship, was fun, and not this limitless judgmental either-or that a lot, unfortunately, of my profession has turned into. This has been the greatest outburst of self-righteous judgmental overreaction since Henry Hyde hung up the shingle at the Judiciary Committee a few years ago.
Last week, Charlie, you concluded that the Anaheim Mighty Ducks were pate, having gone down 0-2 to the Devils of New Jersey in the Stanley Cup Finals, and then the Ducks won two in a row, and now they're down 3-2. Do they win two more and shock the hockey world?
I would like to see it go seven games, just because it's starting to become a fairly intriguing series. But it's going to be very, very hard for the Ducks to win two in a row against these guys. The Devils make you play the way they want you to play better than any other team in the NHL.
If the Devils prevail, and if the Nets beat the San Antonio Spurs in the NBA Finals, we get two champions from New Jersey in the same year. What, if anything, would this momentous development signify?
Oh, I think that the toxic waste would be fairly bubbling with glee. I notice how you delicately danced around the phrase, they would have two teams from the same city winning the championship, since these guys aren't really from a city.
Well, there's no city.
They're from
there.
An exit.
They're from a rest stop.
They're from an exit. Exactly.
Actually, my favorite hockey story of the week has to do with the game the Edmonton Oilers and the Montreal Canadiens will play on November 22nd. It could draw 55,000 fans, but I guess they got to hope for good weather.
I want to go to this, and I want it to snow. Don't you want it to snow? Not a lot, just a little bit. The Oilers and Les Canadiens are going to play outdoors at Commonwealth Stadium. In Edmonton, they think they can get 55,000 fans. It's going to be an old-timers game, which with the Edmonton Oilers means Wayne Gretzky. Mm-hmm. As the late Bob Johnson used to say, it is going to be a great day for hockey. They just need a little bit of snow.
The annual musical chairs demonstration by NBA coaches has been in full swing. I'm not sure I can keep track of who all is going to be where next fall, but I do think Rick Carlisle got unfairly jobbed in Detroit. What exactly did he do wrong?
Well, unfairly jobbed. He's not only unfairly jobbed, he's going to go to an unfair job, namely the Clippers. Mm-hmm. He apparently failed to work and play well with others in the front office. Otherwise, you know, this is a guy who's coach of the year and he gets fired, and now they're going to hand him the Clippers, guaranteeing he will be fired again within 2 years.
Meanwhile, the football coach at the University of Washington is in trouble for participating in an NCAA basketball tournament pool. Should this be a hanging offense?
The NCAA is death on gambling. Now, the NCAA also has the same attitude towards, you know, NCAA basketball pools that the NFL has towards those little cards that you used to get in grammar school. I mean, if the NCAA really wanted to do away with gambling on its basketball tournament, it wouldn't print brackets, but it does. That having been said, Rick Neuheisel, who the NCAA has been looking at for a number of years for a number of reasons, confessed that he put up $5,000 and won $20,000 in an auction format pool in the men's basketball tournament. He got caught. The NCAA is looking at him. They are death on gambling. They don't want their coaches, you know, even associated with the word gambling, let alone with gamblers. Rick Neuheisel could be in trouble.
There was a sister slam at the French Open this year, but the Williams sisters were the slammies rather than the slammers. Is this, in your mind, a refreshing or a disappointing development?
Oh, God, who cares? Who cares about the French Open? Honest to the Lord, how many stiffs have on their resume a Grand Slam title that happens to be the French Open? The Williams sisters are out, which is a good thing. The problem is the Williams sisters are out in favor of people nobody's ever heard of. You've got a bunch of guys who look like the guys who failed the audition for a Brazilian Jon Bon Jovi tribute band. The French Open bothers me as an event because, first of all, it's played on a surface nobody else plays on anymore. Play the thing on chicken salad. It's every bit as arbitrary.
On Thursday, PGA Tour golfer John Rieger challenged Annika Sorenstam to a one-on-one 18-hole stroke play match, claiming he had the backing for a $1 million winner-take-all event. And on Friday evening, Annika, calling the proposal humorous, politely declined. The right choice?
Annika Sorenstam can do better than $1 million to play with a guy who's made 140 on the money list. John Rieger is making an interesting case here. He's saying, look, I really stink. I'm at the bottom of my profession. I am the stuff that sticks to the soap dish of the PGA Tour, and I can beat this woman. Now, first of all, it doesn't really matter whether she plays him. Second of all, she shouldn't waste her time for $1 million. If John Rieger really has backers, let him put up $5 million, and then we'll talk about it.
Last weekend, the possessor of one of your favorite names became the first WNBA player to get past the 2,000-point mark and the 1,000-career rebound barrier on the same night, and that prolific scorer and bounder was...
Shamiqua Holdsclaw, who thereupon went out a couple days later and got hurt and going to miss three games.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she did go past 2,000 points and 1,000 rebounds for the Mystics. She's still one of the more compelling players in that league, and as we often point out, she does have a delectable name.
Finally, Charlie, on the eve of a big game against Denmark, some Norway soccer fans dressed the famous Little Mermaid of Denmark in a Norway jersey, after which a Danish tabloid referred to Norway as, quote, a stinking rich nation of losers. Let the games begin, yeah?
Did you know there was this kind of smack thrown among the herring nations of the world? Good Lord, but I mean, putting the Norway shirt on the Little Mermaid is a bit much.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week for Ludafisk on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Last week's story about cowboy shooting by Karen Given, a.k.a. Sparky, accounted for most of the emails this week. John Mihalik, who hears Only a Game on KJZZ in Phoenix, wrote, "Congratulations, you've finally aired a positive story about guns and shooting. But let me remind you, the center of the universe is not Rhode Island or the East Coast." "Did Sparky tell you how well she did with a six-gun?" inquired One Ear Pete himself in an email. "The woman is a natural shooter." Okay, so I guess Karen gets to do any story she wants from now on. Barbara Kruschwitz, who listens to Only a Game on the web, was one of several people to write to let us know that One Ear Pete really can only hear out of one ear. "It makes it hard for his wife, my sister, to talk to him when they ride in the buckboard," she added. On a show a couple of weeks ago, I spoke with a TV sports show host, James Duthie, in Toronto. His claim to fame was that he'd brought to his program a monkey, a macaque to be precise, who'd had better luck than the hockey experts picking the winners in the early rounds of Stanley Cup play. Rob Ferber, who hears the show on WHYY in Philadelphia, called Only a Game to point out that Mr. Duthie's gimmick was not entirely original.
Dax the monkey picked football winners all fall last year on the Howard Stern show, and I don't know if he stole that idea from somebody else, but he picked against William the Refrigerator Perry and two other members of the show all fall last year.
Lillian Restaino Bauman of Boynton Beach, Florida, emailed us as follows. "I cannot begin to tell you how much I enjoy your show. Where else could I hear in the same program about Roger Angel's new book and the cowboy shooters? When the perennial visitors from the north who come to my Florida home interfere with my Saturday morning ritual, I pout for a whole week." Lynn Marshall, who hears Only a Game on WBFO in Buffalo, was on the way to work when she heard my conversation with Roger Angel. "Thanks for brightening this gloomy morning," she wrote. "I think I'll stop at the bookstore on my way home and pick up a copy of Game Time." You can reach us with your comments by visiting our website, onlyagame.org. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. We live at WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860.
Touch the pole!
The pole that this young striker did eventually touch takes the place of the base, with which you may be more familiar. The striker in this game of a recent Sunday afternoon would be called a batter, and the server would be called a pitcher if the game were contemporary baseball, but it's not.
In this game, we got to play righty. Come on over here.
No lefties allowed?
No lefties in the 1800s.
At Old Sturbridge Village in Sturbridge, Massachusetts, it is the 1830s version of baseball that's available, along with the blacksmithing, crop planting, and other activities more obviously necessary to the sustenance of a small New England town nearly 200 years ago. My guide to the festivities is Devin Kurtz, and he is, he insists, dressed for the occasion.
Normal everyday dress for a farmer or a tradesman
or a middle-class mechanic.
A tie, a nice gold-colored vest, and
very unfashionable straw hat.
And a straw hat. And so is this baseball attire?
Well, it's typical dress, and you know, when we start playing, I might take my coat off. This is the days before uniforms and anything like that. We do know that the Philadelphia Olympics in the 1820s had a uniform for their baseball club, and it was dark blue pants and a white flannel shirt and a low straw hat. But here in the countryside of New England, fellas just played in their normal everyday clothes.
Devin Kurtz, the coordinator of youth and family programs at Sturbridge, brought baseball to the village, an idea that he reluctantly admits has not been universally embraced.
This was our sheep shearing season. It's kind of embarrassing seeing all the ladies working so hard while the fellas and I are just standing out in the common playing ball today.
Whoa!
Oh, that was a good strike.
Off the hands of the left fielder. Uh-oh, we have two guys
out
on one base?
No, it was an out.
Absolutely not.
Okay.
The 1830s rules cause some confusion among the youngsters at play. They're supposed to run the bases clockwise, and some of them don't. The fielders often forget that they can get an out by hitting the runner with the ball, which is called pegging him. But one young striker apparently has figured out how to take advantage of the fact that in 1830s baseball, when the catcher was known as the behind, there was no such thing as foul territory. So a striker had a lot more options than a contemporary hitter enjoys.
I switched the bat around and hit it backwards.
It would have been a foul ball in today's baseball, but not in 1830. How'd you know that?
Well, I overheard you guys talking before, and I thought maybe it would work because nobody's back there except the behind. So.
And sure enough,
it worked.
Note to the Major League Scouting Bureau, this 12-year-old hitter named Brendan from Farmington, Connecticut, is not only sharp, he's sufficiently coordinated to turn around on a pitch and whack a leather-covered, cloth-stuffed baseball backwards into the empty distance with a bat that, as I tell Devin Kurtz, looks more like a walking stick for a very short hiker.
Yeah, that's basically their shape. These are actually the ends of a flail, which is used for knocking the grain off of the stalk, and we liberated them from one of the farms. We find that kids, especially in the 1800s when they played, they made their own equipment, and it's whatever they could find that they put together.
That sort of ingenuity is a possibility too good for the folks at Sturbridge to resist, so they've incorporated it into their baseball experience.
Okay, so we have, 1, 2, 3, 4. Who's sewing?
Sandra Couture, dressed in period costume, stands in the corner of a small wooden building behind a makeshift L-shaped counter of rough boards. She distributes to a dozen children the cloth stuffing and cover that were the makings of an early 19th century baseball. They lack only the musket ball, which might have served as the core of the real thing.
This is the whip stitch. All right, hold the needle in your right hand. Take the needle and put it through the cloth, right to left. Whip it around.
As the kids settle into the cottage industry of baseball making, Sandra Couture, in character, tells a story which further illustrates some of the differences between then and now.
Do you know one year I played baseball. Shh, nobody knows about this, George. And I played it out in front of the parsonage. Mrs. Poole was so upset. She said, look at these grown women playing baseball on a Sunday in front of the parsonage. Oh, but we had such a good time.
Just down the hill from Sandra Couture's cottage is a hall equipped with such modern contraptions as an overhead projector. Here, Tom Kelleher, a research historian at Sturbridge Village, offers a lecture on the history of baseball. His studies have led him to debunk a myth which the folks in Cooperstown, New York, probably wish he'd left alone.
The legend holds that Abner Doubleday invented and codified the rules of baseball in his native town of Cooperstown, New York, in 1839. That last bit, though, of historical trivia, however, has no basis in truth.
Meanwhile, out in the pale sunshine of the New England spring, Devin Kurtz is pounding into the ground the stakes that serve instead of bases, preparing for another game. Next, he will explain the 1830s rules to another group of 21st century players. He always begins the same way.
There's four basic rules that we tell the kids of things they can't do. There's no swearing, spitting, sliding, or stealing of bases. And that's basically it. And then...
Good rules.
You know, we point them in the right direction of which way to run. We teach them how to cheer. And although there's no swearing, we do teach them some words they can say if they, you know, run into the tree accidentally.
These lessons will continue throughout the summer on Sundays at Sturbridge Village. Servers, strikers, and behinds of all ages and both genders are welcome.
Well struck!
Oh, well struck!
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Michael Garth. We had help this week from Lisa Morgan at WYPR in Baltimore. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for the Only a Game newsletter, or perhaps learn more about Native Dancer, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from Devin Kurtz, the coordinator of youth and family programs at Old Sturbridge Village.
The behinds are playing almost 15 to 20 feet back from home base.
Sure. After all, we all know that hindsight is 15-20. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.